Welcome to Conversations That Matter. This episode is brought to you by Odlum Brown, a client-focused investment firm that starts client relationships with straightforward conversations focused on you, your aspirations, and your investment priorities. Odlum Brown has been a supporter of Conversations That Matter from the day we started the show. Their only condition was that we provide a non-biased conversation with people from all sides of all sorts of issues. And of course, we couldn't produce this show without the support of Oh Boy Productions. If you're looking to produce a cast, be it video or pod, I suggest you reach out to Oh Boy. They can help you produce it, and then they can help you build your audience. And we also need your support. I'm asking you to please pledge a dollar per show at patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter. I know I rolled that off really quickly, but those dollars add up and they play an important role in helping us produce this show. Now to this week's episode. Humanoid artificial intelligence is coming, and it very well may come from Vancouver. The brains at work creating AI, especially human-like AI, live and work right here. The odds that they will succeed are high. They have an amazing track record. One of those brains is the mastermind behind the development of quantum computing, a development that has manifested itself into a company known as D-Wave. So, at the core of the development of humanoid AI sits the existential question, what does it mean to be human? What motivates us? How do we decide right from wrong, and whose morals constitute the foundation of the programming of the machine that will self-learn? These are just a few of the questions that surround what many believe will be the last great human discovery. We invited Geordie Rose of Sanctuary AI to join us for a conversation that matters about artificial intelligence. Why, what, when, where, and how soon? I still didn't like it. Then do it again. What?
We're running out of batteries and footage time, by the way. We've got 3 minutes of footage left.
Welcome to Conversations That Matter. This episode is brought to you by Odlum Brown, a client-focused investment firm that starts client relationships with straightforward conversations focused on you, your aspirations, and your investment priorities. Odlum Brown has been a supporter of Conversations That Matter from the day we started the show. Their only condition was that we provide a non-biased conversation with people from all sides of all sorts of issues. Of course, we couldn't produce this show without the support of Oh Boy Productions. If you're looking to produce a video or a podcast, I suggest you reach out to Oh Boy. They can help you produce it, and they can help you build your audience. And we also need your support. Please pledge a dollar per show at patreon.com/conversationsthatmatter, because those dollars add up and play an important role in helping us produce the show. Now to this week's episode. Humanoid artificial intelligence is coming, and it very well may come from Vancouver. The brains at work creating AI, human-like AI, live here, and the odds that they will succeed are high. They have an amazing track record. One of those brains is the mastermind behind the development of quantum computing, a development that has manifested itself into a company known as D-Wave. At the core of the development of humanoid AI sits the existential question, what does it mean to be human? What motivates us? How do we decide right from wrong? And whose morals constitute the foundation of the programming of the machine that will self-learn? These are just a few of the questions that surround what many believe will be the last great human discovery. We invited Geordie Rose of Sanctuary AI to join us for a conversation that matters about artificial intelligence. Why, what, when, where, and how soon?
Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You are making a difference in not only the world of quantum computing, but as a result of that, moves towards artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. But I was fascinated, and where I would like to start today is, I watched a talk with you where you said, well, before we can understand what artificial intelligence will be, we have to understand exactly what it means to be human. Why do we have to start there?
Well, it depends what kind of artificial intelligence you're talking about.
Well, I'm talking about humanoid.
Yeah. So that's the critical thing.
Because yes.
In the original days of AI, back when the term was coined, and people started thinking about computers and what they might be able to do, AI meant that. it meant trying to build machines that thought like people.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not the way that people think of AI today.
They think of it more as machine-based learning?
Well, there's a bunch of different camps. And I shouldn't say that nobody thinks about that, because some do. But the majority of people who work in the field now are applying what are fairly basic ideas to two types of activity. One are what you could call as feature extraction. So imagine you've got a picture,
mm-hmm.
and you want to assign a label to it, which is, say, there's a person in the picture or there isn't a person in the picture. That kind of thing is very difficult to do with conventional computer science ideas, because how do you describe a person?
Mm-hmm.
So you could say, well, they've got two eyes and a nose and so on. But at some point, those levels of description aren't very good.
Mm-hmm.
Just in practice, they don't work very well. If you think about what you would say to describe a cat, and you were to list all of these characteristics, dogs also have nearly all of those that you'd list. There's something about the cat and the dog that look different to you, and it may be hard to put it into words. So the majority of people who work in AI build systems that essentially do that for different kinds of data and different kinds of labels. Now, that is not intelligence. Calling it AI is a big stretch. So sometimes what people do is they start appending some technical jargon like machine learning or supervised learning or something like this. But it's hard for the layperson to distinguish, because
sounds
it's all
more like
the same
nuanced
category.
Analysis.
Well, it's labeling.
Okay.
That's all. So humans are very good at this. So if you look around the room, you can see a lot of things that you identify, and if you think about what the word for that thing would be, it pops into your head.
Mm-hmm.
That's very difficult for machines. And mostly what people have done in the recent few years of AI is try to replicate something like how humans recognize objects, first in images and then in audio, for
mm-hmm.
example, extracting text from speech, and some other weirder modalities, but it's mostly visual stuff and audio stuff, and there's a few other things, but that's basically all of it. So that's the first thing. The second thing, which is more recent and a little bit more interesting, but still not intelligence of any sort, are what are called generative models. So generative model turns that process in reverse. Imagine I were to say the word cat to you and ask you to draw a picture of a cat. So you're going to draw something. So that thing that you've drawn is a picture of a cat. It's not the word cat. So the generative AI attempts to go from symbols, like labels,
mm-hmm.
to objects in the world, like video or images or audio. And those generative things tend to be where all the computer art lies. So if you ask a computer, please generate me a painting in the style of Picasso, what you can do is feed all of the Picasso images into this. It will learn certain features that Picasso uses and then combine them in novel ways to generate a new kind of Picasso. And that works quite well also. So most modern AI is in one of those two categories. And you have to go back to the 60s, 70s, and 80s to get back to what you might consider to be the original roots of AI, which is how do you build machines that think like people, that reason and process information the way people do. This is obviously what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in that first.
Right. Life. And so when it comes to artificial intelligence, you do talk about the fact that to be able to get to that point that you just made about where you want to go, you have to first be able to define what it means to be human. Why is that important?
So it matters a lot if what you're trying to do is build human-like intelligence. Because
mm-hmm.
in order to do that, amongst other things, you have to define what you mean,
mm-hmm.
which means being very clear about what you'd expect a machine that had this property to be able to do or not do. Well, humans do a bunch of things. There's a lot known about how we do them in terms of neuroscience and the way that the brain works. If you're going to build a machine that, say, can have this type of conversation, that machine needs to be very like us. It needs to understand the world the same way we do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see flashes of this in the non-human biological world. If you try to have a conversation with an octopus, it's not going to go very well. It's not because octopi don't function perfectly well as creatures in their environments, and they communicate with each other, of course, they have to.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't communicate with them. And it's not as simple a reason as people tend to think. People tend to think that there's this thing called intelligence, which is like a linear scale, and we're here and octopuses are here or something. And that's not right. So every creature in the world has an unbroken chain of successful evolution going back a billion years. It's ideally suited to its environment and niche, or no, maybe not ideally, but well enough to have survived.
To survive and procreate.
Yeah. So we can't communicate with those guys, not because we're smarter, but because, well, not only that, but there's also a problem that the way that an octopus would understand the world is derived from its experience in the world. It lives underwater. It has eight arms covered with suckers. It eats different kinds of things and needs to know different kinds of things in order to survive. So all of those things are, you can think of as the thought patterns of an octopus, which are so alien to us that even if an octopus was as quote unquote smart as we are, we would have a lot of trouble communicating because the things that it would think about, we don't have human words for. Mm-hmm. So what does it feel like?
You don't
like?
Have the experience either.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So words for us are symbols of experiences in the world. Mm-hmm. A cup, the word, is a symbol that represents our sum total of experience with cups in the world. If we didn't have the ability to use these things or wanting to, we wouldn't form those notions. Mm-hmm. And if we were to communicate with an alien that was, say, made out of gas and lived in a cloud, it wouldn't have any concept of what that thing was in a very deep way. Mm-hmm. And we would have very difficult conversations that would ensue with them. So the reason why I think it's so important to understand how human bodies and minds work is that when you're building a synthetic analog, you have to know what it is you're trying to build. I mean, it's a zeroth order problem. What is it exactly that you're trying to replicate? And so we have to understand things like this.
So when I think about the speed that the processing takes place for me to understand in this conversation what you're talking about, my brain is moving incredibly fast. Mm-hmm. How are we going to be able to create humanoid type artificial intelligence if we can't process the information at that speed? So therefore, how important is quantum computing to be able to get to that stage?
Well, I think once we understand how thought works, we'll be able to use something like off-the-shelf computing technology to embody it. I don't think we need to have big breakthroughs in hardware. But usually what people use hardware for is not actually running something after you know how it works. It's doing all the experiments to figure out what works and what doesn't in the first place. Mm-hmm. So there, we're vastly underpowered. If you think about a company like Google or Facebook or Amazon, they have access to the compute resources that the rest of us don't. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant advantage when you're doing R&D. But that's a different question as to whether or not you could run once you've understood everything on those things. And I think you could. I actually don't think that the way that humans work is necessarily computationally intensive. I think there's a lot of evidence that it isn't because of the very low power draw in our brains. So our brains, while they draw a lot of power compared to the rest of our body, they're not nearly as power draws as even modern, like a desktop computer draws more power than your brain does. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons to believe that that is an indicator that the actual computational load on your brain isn't that high. Now, it's difficult
to know
for sure.
Could that not possibly be an evolutionary development that the body has said, I've got to find efficiencies in the use of energy to be able to power this thing. Otherwise, I'm not going to survive.
Well, we have, I believe, the highest percentage of our energy goes to our brain of any creature on the
25%,
planet.
25%, I think, up to 25%, depending on how active it is.
So that's a lot. Yes. If you think about the other things that you have to do during the day. Shuttling more power than that was probably not effective as a strategy evolutionarily. Like you get to a certain point where I think there's probably diminishing returns on powering more and more of this. Mm-hmm. So we have things that we do quite well, but I think those things are, they're probably not hard in the computational sense. So if you sat down and said, tried to prove Fermat's last theorem or something, like some very, a long-standing, pick a math problem that's been open for like 400, 500 years. You're going to have to grind away with your brain for years trying to think through all of the different possibilities. And you're going to spend an awful lot of time doing that. But mm-hmm. most of the things that people do are not like that. So for example, knowing that this is a cup, that happens in a very short period of time, likely because in your brain, the signals that reach your brain are hitting very specific detectors
yep.
that are specifically like the cup detector. So you can think of it almost like an analog process. Light flows through this network. It turns into electricity. Those electrical signals light up a certain detector, and all of a sudden you know it's a cup. So that's not right. a lot of compute load, but it's a very, it's an amazingly sophisticated computing system that's been built to remove the compute load from it.
So it's been streamlined.
Yeah, everything has been designed so that we can detect things that are important to us quickly. Using these like built-in capabilities.
So I'm hoping that you can move quickly. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm hoping for the singularity.
Right.
I'm told, forget it. It's not going to happen in your lifetime. But it sure would be nice if it did.
Yeah.
Is it even remotely possible? Or is that really just the stuff of science fiction?
So I think right now we have this terminology problem
yeah.
that we do think of intelligence as being some kind of linear scale mm-hmm. where there's things that have more or less of it. That's totally wrong from my perspective. Okay. So the way that I think about this is that the only thing that you do is move. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, like when you speak or you write, you can write the Shakespearean sonnets, but really all you're doing is moving your hand over the page.
Yeah.
So all our bodies do is move. What we call intelligence is somehow derived from good movement. So if you move in a way that you might consider good, people call that intelligent. So for example, if I can have this conversation, mm-hmm. it means I'm moving my lips in a certain way that you would potentially view as being, I have the capability to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if we brought in, my pet cat and sat her down here, she wouldn't have that conversation because she's not moving her mouth parts in the right way.
Right.
So the way that we think of intelligence is that it's a property of being able to predict the outcome of your actions because you're always acting in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So if I'm doing something, it's always now. And so these things then have consequences that fold out through time. And sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. And we think of somebody who has this property as taking actions that accrue benefit to that person or whoever they care about over longer and longer time periods. And the people who are the most intelligent are able to discern ways of acting that affect things that are very far in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So if I wanted to, say, run for become Prime Minister of Canada, I would have to start planning now for something that might happen in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to be able to think through all of that and to come up with something that would be ultimately successful. So for us, intelligence in machines is not some magic superpower. It's about being able to have a good model of the world. That is, you understand the consequences of your actions and then being able to figure out which actions should I take to get the benefit to me that matters most.
Okay.
So that's a separate issue. So yes. One of them is, am I good at getting what I want? Let's call that intelligence. And then the other one is, what is my motivation? Which mm-hmm. is totally separate. And a lot of people don't understand this, is that our motivations are so connected to our intelligence that we don't think of them as separate. But when you build a machine, you get to say what its motivations are. And we don't think of that in these terms, but like say a toaster
mm-hmm.
only has one motivation.
Brown toast.
Right.
Yeah.
So we don't think of it that way because it's a simple mechanism where if you push it down, it does its thing. But computers that learn and adapt and have self-models and models of the world, they are a little different. And you have to start thinking about what motivation does this machine have to learn and adapt and make decisions and move. And we get to choose those things. And what we want to do at Sanctuary is... make machines that are human-like, but focus on what you could call the better angels of our nature. You mm-hmm. know, humans have certain characteristics that we value and think are moral and ethical and good. And then we have a whole bunch of others that aren't.
Yeah.
And you don't have to look far to see that second category. So what we're trying to figure out is there a way to build a machine that embodies like a Haig, for example?
Right.
Somebody like him.
Hague Ferris,
yeah. Right, that it embodies all that's good in humanity. Can you make a machine that's like that by giving them the right kinds of motivation and reward for behaviors that create social good,
mm-hmm.
And avoiding motivating them to do things like be weapons or cause chaos? A lot of the AI that's deployed today in the world is causing chaos. Facebook, for example. People don't understand that most weaponized social media, the weaponization platform is what you could think of as AI.
Mm-hmm.
They're large-scale computer programs that have malicious actors behind them that are attempting to manipulate people. So that's an example of a bad way to take AI. But I do think that we have this optional path in front of us that we can try to create AI that is for social good.
Mm-hmm.
And not just because I think it's a good idea, although I do, but if you think about it from the business perspective, sowing chaos is a short-term strategy. Like if you're going to...
Because it creates need.
Yeah,
yes.
Mm-hmm. But it's short-term.
Yes.
It leads to the declining of the stability of the population. If you create something that enhances social good, it glues people together and it enhances stability. And stability is what you need to grow technology and science and wealth and all of that.
Okay, well, I got to touch on a point that I saw you talk about, that technology ultimately will make capitalism redundant, or maybe not redundant, but impossible to support.
Yeah, they're incompatible.
Yeah. What happens then? You develop these machines, but you don't need me any longer.
UBI, Universal Basic Income. And the way that to implement it is very clear. So the concept is that so the way that things work now in the simplified economic model is you have companies who pay people to do things, and then those companies create wealth, a part of which goes to the government as tax. And then the people who've generated the wealth, part of their paycheck goes to the government also. And the government gets taxed from both sides. So as technology grows in its capabilities, what happens is companies replace the labor of people with machines. So they stop paying humans. They pay machines instead, a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
And the profit grows, but that profit doesn't flow back to the people. Instead, it collects inside the company. So there's a very simple solution to this. Because those people are no longer getting money from the corporations, and the corporations are making more and more, the corporations need to pay more tax.
Mm-hmm.
That tax goes to the government that now pays the people. So it reverses the arrow. Instead of you paying tax to the government, in the future, what's going to happen is the government is going to pay you. And the reason for this is very simple. It's that unless that happens, the people who are the government serves are going to have no capital. And they're going to,
riot against it or rebel against it.
Yeah. And yeah. So you're going to have this very terrible situation where wealth collects inside companies, and there are only a few people who own all of that wealth. Like there's three people who own half the United States. That's where technology and capitalism in its current model ends. So what we have to do is replace that with a very simple system, and it's not difficult, and it makes total sense that companies have to pay what you could think of as an automation tax. The more of a corporation that's automated, the more money they pay to the government in tax. And then the government redistributes that money to everybody in the form of universal basic income. So this idea is really simple. It will work, and it will be the way that we go
forward. Will it be a better world than the one that we're currently in right now?
Absolutely.
Because there's an awful lot of acrimony.
Yeah. So the bottoming out of the middle class and people who want to work, but the opportunity is not there. And even redefining what a job is. Like if you think about what people count as jobs now, those shouldn't be counted. A job for an adult is a wage that allows you to support yourself and your family. It's not working for $15 an hour. That's mm-hmm. not a job. That's what you do when you're a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
A job is something where you make enough money so that you can have the sorts of things that you'd expect you'd have in a first world country. Now, So I think that will it be better? Yes. And the reason is that you break the unhealthy link between labor and being able to live. So right now, everybody has in the back of their head this fear that if I don't exchange the sweat of my brow for money, I can't feed myself and my family. I'm going to lose my house.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a terrible situation for a technologically advanced civilization that doesn't need that to be the case to be in. We can automate out today most people's jobs.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think that's a good thing is that we can pay for all of that, again, by taxing corporations, this kind of automation tax, and then redistributing that money back to the citizenry. It doesn't mean that if I own a big profitable company, I'm not going to be incredibly wealthy. If I have, let's say I'm worth $100 billion because I own company X, I can give away half of that to the government. And I won't notice a difference because I can only wear one suit at a time. Mm-hmm. And the difference between $50 billion and $100 billion is not material to me. I don't care who you are. That's not a difference. You will not notice a difference no matter what you're doing. There's no project that you can imagine where you'd need to invest $100 billion in it.
So you envision a world where artificial intelligence and technology is going to rewrite the social order.
Absolutely, and for the better. It will be all of the drudgery of life is going to be done by machines that are better at those things than we are. And it'll be almost like, okay, right now, you don't think about the, let's say when you turn on the tap, water comes out and you know, it's kind of free.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really think about that. What if everything was like that?
Okay. I can't help but go to a place where I start to think, okay, what is the meaning of life? Does my life have value? And for me, I am contributing to something by my very existence, and therefore I affect change. If I'm not engaged in the world of work, what then do I do to have that same kind of impact and hopefully drive meaning for my time here on Earth?
So that is an excellent question. I think, okay, so I'm lucky enough that I don't have to work anymore. I've been very fortunate financially, I suppose, in the things that I've done. But I do anyway.
Right.
Because, and I would claim, actually, that a lot of what I do could be better done by machines now. But I would do it anyway. And I think that this idea that you wouldn't do something that you love to do because there's somebody or something that's better at it than you is a really, it's a wrong idea.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I might like to play basketball and I might do it, you know, a couple times a week because I enjoy it, but I don't stop playing basketball because Michael Jordan could demolish me in one-on-one. I mean, I know that. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to be as good as LeBron James ever. I know. But that doesn't mean I don't enjoy what I do, and I can't participate in this for both for my own self-satisfaction and also a social thing with others.
Yeah.
So work doesn't have to be an endless grind. Like, there are different kinds of work.
Mm-hmm.
You can enjoy what you do, and you would do it even if you didn't have to. A lot of content creators, I think, are like that. So I've been listening to a lot of writers talk about their craft, and this thing that comes up over and over again is that most of them have jobs that aren't writing, so they have to stuff the writing in the morning or sometime, and they report doing it because they feel like they have to. They don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people have these things, like something that you'd really want to do if you could or spend more time on it, and the fact that you have to work a job doesn't change any of that. And I think what will happen in this post-scarcity economy that I'm describing is that, yes, there are going to be a lot of people who just sit on the couch playing video games. And I don't have any problem with that. Why not? Because, you know, that might be the thing that you really like to do. And it might actually be something that gives you joy and satisfaction. And then there are going to be people who are not satisfied with that, and they're going to want to do other things, and they'll do those too, but they don't have to. They're doing it because they want to. So there's a huge difference. And this world that I'm describing, I think, is coming. It's coming in the not too distant future, because it has to. Because if you don't do this, there's going to be widespread social problems.
When you say the not too distant future, are you talking quarter century or less?
Less. I'd say that unless we start doing something about this. So on the time scale of, say, the introduction of the driverless car.
Yeah.
So who knows when that's going to be, but it's probably within, 10 years that'll be deployed and scale. So that is not too far away, and that will displace a lot of workers. The company I worked at prior to Sanctuary builds products that are robots for warehouses. If you're a warehouse worker, you're not going to be doing that job in 10 years. I'm almost certain. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot more people who work in warehouses than drive for a living. So this is coming immediately. And I used to be concerned that governments wouldn't be able to react fast enough to this, because they wouldn't be able to get their ducks in a row, and people would be looking at the wrong kinds of problems, like walls, for example, where the things that really mattered were not being paid attention to. But I actually don't believe that now. I think that at least in the United States, on the Democrat side, this understanding of the dangers of the automated economy, virtually every person on that side understands that this is an issue. And I think it's going to actually be an important issue in the upcoming election in the United States. So these things are starting to raise their head above simple, like, academics talking at conferences. Now we're talking about something that really is going to have to happen, or else there's going to be problems.
It's an interesting world that we're moving into.
It is.
And we designed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't believe in free will, so I'm not sure we had anything to do with it. But
okay, that's an entirely different discussion for another day. All right. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks.